Well, it is fantastic for my latest Nostalgia interview to catch up with Christina Kim. And Christina, we were just saying that we've known each other for, it must be about a decade.
It's just about a decade because I arrived here in Kent in October of 2013.
Wow.
I remember the month because it was, I arrived mid-term because of visa issues. And so I never had a, like an intro or anything. So I was just kind of running around asking people how do you do this and how do you do that? Because I've never had a proper intro.
Do you know, it does happen that way because I remember starting one job on the 1st of October. Mm. And when I first went to university as an undergraduate, we always started sort of first week of October. So mm-hmm. that so the university year was always sort of October to June. But in later years, it would always start mid to late September, especially with Welcome mm-hmm. Week events. And so I think you're absolutely right. So there was one job I started before coming to Kent. When it began, they wanted me to start on the 1st of September, but I couldn't have given 2 months' notice or 3 months, whatever it was, on my previous job. So I started 1st of October, and there was that perception of walking in when the students are like, well, we've been waiting for at least a week. Where have you been, sir? Yeah. Kind of thing.
Yes, exactly.
But you had a good reason. Out of your hands.
So I kind of faked it for that first few weeks to make it to the end of that first term. But I guess, I don't know. It still took me a few years, I think, before I kind of knew faces and names, you know, because the way Sekhol was at the time, we were quite big. And also, I would have a lot of people who looked familiar, but I didn't know exactly which subject. They were either religious studies or German, but I'm not sure which one. So yeah, a few years like that.
Well, I started exactly 20 years ago in 2004, yeah. And there was a board in those days with photographs of all the staff. Now, some of the staff either had refused or been unable to have recent photographs taken. So there were some that clearly going back a few years or decades. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, some staff with beards that they didn't have now. So because I was thinking, oh, is that that person? I couldn't tell. But what was really funny is that I'd meet somebody in the corridor and they'd say, oh, hi, how are you settling in? And I go, oh, fine, lovely to meet you. And then I was so mortified that I didn't know who they were, but yet they knew me. That when they weren't looking, I go to the board
and
look for them so that next time I saw them, I go, hi, Laura, or hi, yeah. Anne, or whoever it might be.
Yeah.
So we got there. And so because I know you're from California.
Yes, yeah. From
Los Angeles. So is that where you were before you came
no,
here?
No, I jumped around a few places. So I grew up in Los Angeles, went to uni in Boston. So I was there for 4 years. And then, let's see. So my PhD years are kind of broken into part one and part two. So part one was back in Los Angeles at UCLA, and then part two was in upstate New York. And then I was in Chicago. I'm actually doing the hand motions geographically. So I was in Chicago doing a postdoc, and that's where I was when I got my current job and I moved here.
Yeah.
So I had been around in the US, but I hadn't lived outside of the US.
Yeah.
I was like traveled around, but I had never lived.
Yeah. Although you just reminded me, because obviously I didn't go for work purposes, but when I went to Sundance,
yeah.
2 years running, the first year, because I hadn't been to the United States for quite a few years,
yeah.
And there were all those issues, and I was only going for a week, and I didn't have the ESTA, and I didn't think they'd let me go, and they did, amazingly. There was some fast track system whereby, I guess because I said, you know, I didn't have any records that were going to likely to stop me from arriving, and I was just mortified because I was only going for a week or so, and because my trip had been organised by the, I think I may have had to book the flight myself, mm-hmm. and I just assumed that everything was in place. I just, to be honest, in a busy job, busy life, I didn't give it a moment's thought. But in your case, I can imagine the visa thing would have taken months.
It took, I don't even remember. It was kind of all hazy. It took a while, and then even after getting here, it was like literally cannot begin working until this time. So I just, you know, didn't arrive until then. And then the most difficult part of the entire process was getting a bank account.
Yeah. Well, in the UK.
In the UK, because you need all the other things. You can't get a bank account until you have a home address. You can't have a home address. You need a mobile phone. You can't get a mobile phone until you have a home address and all those things. And so I remember, like, I had to bring some official-looking document that says, yes, I'm employed by the University of Kent, and I will eventually have a home address.
And also, I've had students, like PhD students, from one was from North Africa and Algeria, yes, it was. Yeah. And I remember that she seemed to be spending more time going to the embassy
Yeah.
To sort, you know, so sometimes she'd say, "Oh, I'm afraid I can't come to the tutorial because I've got to go back to the embassy," because it wasn't her fault. But you know, there was a part of me that almost felt like contacting the embassy and saying, "Look, I know you have to do this, but she just wants to do her PhD, and I want to supervise her. And you know, all she's doing is going to the embassy. I'm sure it's good reason to do it, but this,
Yeah.
but it doesn't seem to be, you know, to be very good use of someone's time. They come over on a visa, where of course the whole point is that they're working X number of hours and they're full time and gainfully
Yeah.
employed, and yet
Yeah.
all they seem to be doing is
Just
bureaucracy."
traveling to and from the
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So anyway, but you've been here 10 years, so at least it settled down.
Yeah.
Well, that
Yeah.
side of things
That
settled
side of
down.
things settled down. Yeah,
Yeah.
always excitement. It's very cool, I have to say. It's very cool you went to Sundance. I've always wanted to go. Cool.
Yeah, I was lucky because I write all these film reviews.
Yeah.
And again, one of the many obsessive things that I sort of do, but it's kind of nice when sometimes you do these things simply because you have this inner need to do it, and then somebody says, "Ah, you're just who we're looking for. Would you like to come to Sundance?"
Yeah.
And now it was during term time, and at beginning of term as well. And I'm not one for missing classes, but I also knew that, you know, if there was a way, there was no, you know,
Yeah.
this chance may never, and realistically will never come up again. So I did. So I spent a week or so just watching loads of films and reviewing them
Amazing.
in exactly the way that I would, but just in a more exotic location.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's very cool.
So I was very pleased with that. So you've been here 10 years now. Do you want to say a little bit as well, of course, about what you do, which is, well, obviously linguistics, but you can say it far
Linguistics.
more eloquently than I can.
Well, actually, this has something to do with the reason why I have part one doctoral years and then part two, because actually I have training in kind of two different fields. So I have kind of classical, traditional linguistics background, but also a psychology background or a cognitive science background. And these were two things that I never really properly thought of as a single thing until I was already kind of in it. So after spending the first part of my PhD years in a traditional linguistics background, I then moved to a place that was really strong for cognitive science and linguistics. So I basically did, I did the coursework for two PhDs. I once kind of cheekily asked my supervisor, like, "Can't I get two PhDs out of this?" And he said, "Two PhDs means two dissertations." So I said, "I'd rather not do that." It's like
And
one
also double, and also
PhD.
presumably double the fees.
So that's how, that's kind of what I do. So I do methodologically, I do experiments on with humans, and all the questions I ask by doing those experiments have to do with linguistics or language, how it's used, both how it's kind of interpreted. So on the receiving end, when you say stuff to me, how do I interpret those words and phrases and et cetera, including things that you may not say but might be suggested by what you say, and then the other way around as well. So how do I put those things together, starting from some kind of a thought that isn't words, and somehow that comes out as a stream of speech sounds, right? So all those kind of individual steps that the cognitive system does to be able to do those things, that's kind of the stuff that I do.
Yeah, and it sounds like it has a really good, very practical sort of dimension, because I was reflecting because Eleni, one of your colleagues,
Oh, yeah.
was somebody I interviewed most recently, and she does a lot of stuff with popular culture. And I
Yeah.
was thinking about this because when I'm doing, say, this podcast, I'm aware that I'm interviewing real people. You know, there's a sort of a real sort of yeah, Chris interviews AI. No, but you know, there's a real sense of a real biography that's there to be, you know, talked about. But often my research is much more sort of theoretically driven. I mean, I suppose, I think with like film reviews, I suppose there's an element there of me physically going to a cinema and writing a review. So it's got that sort of this worldly underpinning. But that's something that's always struck me. Maybe it was the type of education I had, very traditional education in the 90s, whereby it was a case of, well, if you want to know the answer to a question, you go to a book. Oh, and you go to a series of books. You take all the books out of the library in those days, physically out of the library, and you find all the arguments, and you'd put them into your. You'd be quoting galore. You quote from all these wonderful sources, and then you'd get a good mark. You know, that was the sort of trajectory, and that's worked for me, and that's sort of the way I've been trained to write. But there's also a part of me that also knows that that's an important part of who I am, but it doesn't apply and mustn't apply in other facets of my life. You know, I keep a diary, but obviously I don't. Yeah. Well, obviously that's not published. But also the diary doesn't follow that same sort of rubric. So it's interesting how sometimes we're trained to operate and to function in one way, mm-hmm. but actually there's another part of us, the counterpoint, that says, "Oh no, you know that actually doesn't quite, you know, do what it should do to sort of make you feel complete."
Yeah, no, I think that's a really interesting point. I also had part of my training was very much this kind of theory-driven, kind of abstracted, acute couple layers, all of that. In fact, I'm going to maybe mess this up, but there's a quote from Chomsky, the kind of father of linguistics, that is something like, just paraphrasing, like the data will show you what the theory should be, but you know, with an appropriate amount of idealization or something, and all of the kind of super empirical, like sciencey grad students at the time used to love to poke at that and say, like, oh, idealization of the data, that just means like hand waving over the data, not actually taking it seriously. But I do think it's kind of it's kind of no fun if it's all at one level, on this very abstract level, or all at this entirely empirical level, because it's kind of the tension, I think, that is really crucial to having certain kinds of insights, being able to ask certain questions. So that's important to me.
Yeah, yeah. And actually that's a really important point, because you can't do one without the other. Mm-hmm. You can't do the field work without knowing how you're going to do something with that field work. In other words, there has to be some sort of underpinning.
Yeah.
In the same way, I mean, this is, you know, this podcast is a huge passion of mine, but I wouldn't imagine that I would sort of say, you know, this is like an academic article, because obviously, you've got two people talking and there may be good insights in there, but it's what one would do with it if it was, the equivalent of an academic piece. And so I think I've shifted over the years, but it's funny how sometimes we're trained in a certain way and we don't really deviate from that, or at least, you know, and like with our students, we, you know, if a student says, how do I write a good essay? What's my go-to? I'd probably and will probably give the same sort of advice that I was given 30-odd years ago, even though I'm fully aware that 30 years ago, or 33 when I went to university, everything was handwritten.
Mm-hmm.
And although I did most of my assignments from my second year undergraduate onwards on computer, you know, the technology was very basic compared to mm-hmm. today. Mm-hmm. So you certainly wouldn't be looking at online resources or JSTOR or anything. You know, you'd physically have to go to the library. And unless you worked in the library, take the books out. So there's a part of me that even now when I'm talking to students, I still speak in exactly the same way, even though I then qualify it by, oh, but obviously there are other ways of doing things. So that's a curious, and maybe it's not a bad thing, because it shows that that's almost like that's what you've been trained. You're taking it with you. But sometimes we forget that 30 years, in my case, 30 years has intervened and I have to catch up.
Yeah, but I think part of that is because, you know, that's by learning and, you know, doing assignments or whatever in that way, that's what taught you how to think, right? So you're used to thinking that way. So when you think about it, you know, the beginning of some piece of work, that's kind of where your mind goes. And I think similar for me, like, so I think those kind of, I don't know, almost like muscle memory things. Yeah, I think about that sometimes too when I'm, you know, talking to students now. And I realize their context is very different. Their context is very different. But yeah, it's good.
But that's a good point, isn't it? Because what is the question is, what is the starting point? You mentioned that, you know, the interplay between experience and theory. That because when I started doing the podcast in 2018, I knew I was going to write a book on nostalgia.
Mm-hmm.
And it was always going to be a more sort of theory-driven exercise. But the counterpoint was when people said, oh, you're doing something on nostalgia, let me tell you my life story. And then I thought, oh, I should be recording these. Then I did. But actually, whereas at one point I thought that the interviews might in some way feed into my writing, they didn't. I've kind of kept them separate. I'm sure they've influenced and guided me in many ways. And I've used lots of radio material, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So I suppose it's drawing with oral testimony, but not necessarily my own oral testimony. Yeah. Maybe in the future, who knows, there will be a place for this. But But there is that, it's the chicken and egg thing, isn't it? What comes first, the theory or the practice? Do we present something because we're driven theoretically and it's the latest paradigm we want to show off about? Or is it a real, like, you know, in the light of all the things going on in the world, whether it's Brexit or all the COVID and all the big political upheavals and what's happening in higher education, that becomes the driver. So it's an interesting question as to which one leads the other, which one follows.
Yeah, and I'll just mention the obvious, which is that you haven't just said, come and do my podcast and we'll just have a chat. It's called the Nostalgia Podcast, right? So that already labels the whole thing and frames it in a way. So, I'm not sure exactly how that hooks into what we're saying.
Well, and on that, a perfect seg, because I was going to ask you about growing up, in California, because I don't know really, because, I mean, when I was growing up, I didn't do very much travelling. So, I mean, accents is always an interesting thing. So I always think, in a world now where people have got access to everything on the internet, at one point, naively, I thought, oh, are people going to lose their sort of, you know, are we all going to speak the same? Because we, you know, rather than live in, like my grandparents grew up, if it hadn't been for the Second World War, they would have lived in the same village, you know, and they would never have moved. But these days, everything is sort of global and we travel. It's quite normal to, you know, from one part of the world to another, not just one from one village to another.
Yeah.
But at the same time, growing up, there's always that exotic, that allure of another country. But when you're, you know, of a certain age or in a profession like this, where you're quite used to going, in my case, to Sundance and then, you know, other countries and you come back, you see the world through a different, more, a more diverse prism, should we say. But growing up in California, now you're in Canterbury, does it all feel very different? Would your younger self have thought, no, this couldn't be my life.
It does feel very different. Here's a peculiar thing about growing up in Los Angeles. So a kind of inside joke amongst people who grew up in the kind of Southern California, broader area. If you say that you grew up in Los Angeles, often it means a little town that's 3 hours drive away from Los Angeles. So if someone says, I'm from Los Angeles, the response will always be like, oh, you mean like Torrance or one of these other places. But I did grow up in Los Angeles, so if you walk outside of my parents' house and look to the right directly, there's the Hollywood Hills and then the Paramount Pictures tower thing. So that's how I used to tell how foggy it was, because I used to ride my bike to school. But it's strange, because growing up, having your childhood in LA is a little bit different from everything that everyone else knows about LA, because you can't do all the things that LA is like known about. Or you can't engage in like the adult culture of Hollywood or any of that, right? So in a way, my world was just as small as anyone else's world would have been kind of during that age. And especially back then in the 80s, when it was still kind of like, I mean, internet and stuff eventually existed, but it wasn't so kind of easily accessed as it is now. So it was still a moment when, when I went to uni, it did feel like moving to a very, very different place. It's Boston, whatever. It's a different place. And in fact, more weird than moving from Los Angeles to Boston was suddenly being in a place, in a university, like in any university town, where there are people from all over the U.S. and elsewhere in this kind of densely packed place, right? And so I found it strange. My two flatmates in my first year, one was from Hopatcong, New Jersey, and was a Chinese-American kid who liked Weezer. And another one was this very kind of... No, I was just calculating the chances that she will ever listen to this.
Yeah.
This girl from Kalamazoo, Michigan, who was like a highly trained gymnast and was really good at math. And so I was like, this is very strange. Right? So it was the first time where there were people from kind of lots of different places. And I guess I kind of realized that there are other dimensions along which you can connect with people. Because there are lots of ways in which, as a child, I kind of didn't fit in multiple ways. And then there are always, you know, continue to be those ways in which I feel like I don't quite fit in. But like I started to realize kind of there are different dimensions along which you can find connection. And that's the kind of the story of the rest of life.
Well, yeah, but also there's something there about, say, California, because everyone knows something about California because they've seen it literally in the movies.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember the first time I went to America, I went to New York, mm-hmm. and California as well as part of that honeymoon, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, because I grew up and loved Scorsese, and, you know, I thought New York, yeah. So I had this beautiful image of a sort of, you know, New York in the movies. And when I went there, of course, it was like, not what was what I expected.
Bumping shoulders with lots of people and getting off the subway and feeling filthy.
Yeah, but and also even in California, now this is the thing that I learned as well. The tipping culture was something I never grasped, and it was humiliating that sometimes you were aware that, you know, you'd given a scowl almost in some places because you know you didn't know the etiquette. But what I found is that I was in a different part of the world, but part of me thought, wow, I'm, you know, you're walking along the Hollywood, the Walk of Fame,
mm-hmm.
but you might see, I don't know, Dolly Parton, or you might see all these, you know, fabulous names. But around, this is the strange thing, there was a lot of deprivation.
Yeah, the Hollywood strip is really dirty. Yeah.
And I couldn't get my head around it, because I thought, hang on, there are all these names of famous stars here, but you look up, and it felt there was a real edginess and a real sense of, I thought Hollywood, I just imagined that, because you know that's all this, where all the celebrities live, and they have went on the Hollywood tour, and you found that they live in their mansions. But you're looking around thinking, that's not what I'm seeing. And again, it's one of many naiveties, but again, it's what happens when you grow up and you believe, or you know, your framing is what you've seen on a television or in the cinema. And I think there's no substitute for real world interaction.
Yeah, it is. It's a very, I love that, all these kind of overlapping things about Hollywood, just because now that I live outside of the US and haven't actually lived in LA for a long time, I can see how it's perceived from, you know, but then I also know, you know, you go to the Hollywood Walk of Fame and it's just scuzzy and grungy and kind of, you know, there are probably pickpockets and, you know, lots of stores selling dodgy stuff. And then just along that same stretch is, you know, the Man Chinese Theater, which is glorious and all this stuff. So yes, it's all mixed in together in a way. I love that. I know a lot of people kind of have so people I've talked to who have just visited LA for like, I don't know, for one quick trip, seem to either really like it or really dislike it. And I understand both, all of those things, right? So actually my kind of most nostalgic years in LA were when I went back as, while I was doing my PhD for the first 5 years or so. Because of course then I was, you know, I was in my early 20s, like do everything. So I kind of discovered everything again. And, I do feel, quite lucky to have grown up in that, in a place where it was actually, you know, access to a lot of culture things, not just movies, but also just like art and music and all this stuff was, something I took for granted, absolutely, and didn't realize that was a really special thing until I didn't live there, right? But, you know, just talking about the movie theaters, I remember, like, once I had a car and I could take myself anywhere, right? Then there were, you know, any Thursday, Friday, Saturday evening, there was the range to pick from if you wanted kind of like set aside the kind of like mall complex multiplex things, but like there, if you want to see kind of a big mainstream international or kind of a art house but mainstreamer, that would be the Lemley Sunset 5. Hard to get parking there, but you know, no other way to get there. And then there would be the New Art in Santa Monica that was similar but small. They only played maybe two pictures at a time, and usually one was a revival and one was some foreign film that was new. And so, and then, let's see, the New Beverly, which Quentin Tarantino bought. The New Beverly used to be a Lemley theater. It was on this stretch where there was a coffee shop that I used to go to a lot to do work in. And it was very close to there on the other side of the street. It was, for the longest time during my childhood, that when ticket prices were going up and up and up, that was still somewhere you could get $2 tickets, and they would do double bills. So you'd do $2 ticket double bills, and then obviously they went out of business. So when it was going to go out of business, Quentin Tarantino bought it. I forget when this was. So he has, as you can probably imagine, this massive collection of reels, like whatever, his personal collection. And so now it's like his little playground where he just plays whatever he likes. So that's the new Beverly. And all these other little kind of theater places where you'd be like, oh, right, don't want to see that one. That one's playing there, so this other place won't be playing this. But to kind of have that there was such a luxury. Looking back on it, I kind of have nostalgia for that I didn't know I would have at the time.
Yeah, because I grew up, this is the funny thing, I'm from the city, from Cardiff, but I went to university in Lampeter, which is in far west Wales, and was there for 10 years. I did a PhD that looked at film, and yet, if I didn't drive in those days, if I wanted to go to the cinema, and I did, I'd have to get a bus. And there was a bus that left Lampeter at 8:40 in the morning. It would go down to Swansea and Cardiff in that order. So, you know, you'd have more, you'd have an extra 2 hours if you stayed in Swansea than Cardiff. And I did that every Saturday. And in later years, I did it on a Sunday as well, because I needed to, because that was my
that's
ticket out.
That's such dedication, though. That's,
but and of course, when I moved to Kent, it was almost like, oh, you know, suddenly, but there's a cinema too close. And even now, this is hilarious, because where we're sitting in my office, we're just a stone's throw away from the Gulbenkian.
Yeah.
Now, so there's a cinema which shows a good range of films, literally, 10 feet, you know, from where we are. How often do you think I go there? Well, it's a rhetorical question. I'll go down to Ashford or Dover, or I'll go to the cinemas in Canterbury. But I'm always travelling. So maybe it's in me, that sort of that ritual, that pilgrimage almost element. It's almost like, it can't be guilt, but, you know, to have a cinema on the doorstep almost feels like, no, you have to make an effort. Because otherwise, it's as well, people say, well, why, I once went to see North by Northwest at the BFI, and someone said, well, why are you going all the way to London and paying on the trip? They're saying, well, but I've got on VHS or Blu-ray here. Why don't you borrow the copy? Thinking, no, that's not the point. You know, but it's interesting, isn't it? So you were in, because I remember going to Century City and seeing, so this was 2002, and I saw Bourne Identity, Austin Powers, was it Goldmember? And I saw Eight-Legged Freaks. I saw, the Spielberg classic, Minority Report. But they were all sort of big budget films. But of course, I was on foot. Didn't really know what sort of, how to even navigate public transport. So I didn't get further. So it sounds as though, obviously you were living there, you knew your way around. But it sounded like there were some really good go-to places. If you knew where they were, you could get the diversity that you needed.
Yeah, and that is one of the things about LA, is that is, especially in those days, not really a walkable city.
Yeah.
And in recent years, basically ever since in the last 10 years or so, there's much, much better public transit. But when I was a kid, it was kind of a nightmare. Like, buses were not even that safe, and, you know, no one really used them. So at that time, at least, it was kind of crucial to be able to drive around, which is, of course, one of the stereotypes about LA. I mean, there's some movie, I think, where they're making fun of LA, and someone is going over to the house next door, and they get in there. What film is that? Do you remember? So they like back their car out of their own driveway and drive it into their neighbor's driveway and get out. It's a joke.
I could imagine Tarantino playing on that in something like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, but it's one of those, not American Pie, but one of those sort of thing. Yeah,
yes,
Brat
yes.
Pack or not.
So
Brat,
I totally.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I know. Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
And
of course, it's also what you're used to, and also, of course, as you rightly say, obviously nostalgia is the framing here, and that's the thing, because it's that intersection. So I mean, nostalgia is literally bitter and sweet, and that's the thing, because I there's a part of me that, of course, I go to university reunions and I'm attached in a way that it took me many years to feel comfortable to get back into that space of school, because I always feel quite ambivalent about school days for me personally. You know, I wouldn't be where I am today if it wasn't for the education that I had. But also, there's a lot about my growing up, my childhood, where, you know, it's that whole thing about fitting in. Mm-hmm. And I think I fit in much better now because it's okay to be a bit weird, a bit neurodivergent or so on. But when those labels didn't exist, of course, then in a way people didn't always know how to deal with somebody who had all these obsessions and interests and, you know, that sort of fitting in thing. But looking back, there's a part of me thinks that it's almost like reclaiming the narrative. Mm-hmm. It's almost like saying, okay, like I didn't go to the cinema when I was young, but I'd listen to the radio and know all the movie songs. But now when I see those movies, and of course I've rather made up for it in over the years, what am I taking back to? Those school ground conversations. Those conversations with friends, in some cases I'm still in touch with, mm-hmm. who are, you know, we talk about those films that I couldn't contribute to because I didn't watch them. But now when I watch them, as I am now 51, it's almost as though I can complete those conversations that they were having around me at the age of 15. It is very, very strange, but there's almost that sense that my time to do some of those things had yet to come, whereas some of those people who may have gone to the cinema all the time at that age, they probably don't do it anymore. So in a way, it's just like, you know, it's almost as though I was pacing myself differently to most people.
Yeah. Oh, that's really interesting. Yeah, there are many of these things where I think kind of reclaiming and going back and fitting your current self back into some kind of a narrative, even if it wasn't a narrative that existed at the time, right? You kind of impose this particular kind of structure on the past. Yeah, that's, I think I do a lot of that in various ways. Yeah. This is related, I think. Maybe, we'll see. But when you were talking, you just reminded me of a moment that I had with my school friends in grade school that has always really stuck in my memory. And it was, let me try to reconstruct it. They were talking about the film The Bodyguard, right? My parents, my mom especially, didn't just let me go see any movie and kind of didn't let me just buy CDs on my own, right? Like so it kind of led this weirdly structured life that where I felt like I wasn't really exposed to a lot of pop culture. But on top of that, we're an immigrant family, right? So there's a lot of popular culture I wouldn't get anyway because, you know, my parents weren't playing the same records at home as my friends were. And so in this discussion on the playground or whatever about The Bodyguard, I figured out it was a film, and then the thing I could not, was just trying so hard to figure out, is Whitney Houston, is she an actress or is she a singer, right? And I was just like, God. But then they said this thing that makes it seem like she's famous for singing. So I was just like, obviously not contributing anything to the conversation, but these moments where I was just like desperately trying to like make things fit with the partial conceptual kind of background and context that I had, just trying to make things work. And I think that kind of feeling of kind of frustration and trying to make things fit is such a familiar feeling to me.
But I mean, I have that in a different way, because I have my go-to people, like the movie stars or the radio presenters.
Yeah.
But my children have none of that. I mean, I used to write the charts down on a Sunday, yeah. the music charts. My children, you know, none of that. But they'll watch things on like YouTube, and they'll know these YouTubers, and they'll be influenced by them sufficiently to watch all their stuff. And I sometimes walk in and just think, what is this? and I do TV every week. They never watch me. They never listen, because it's not, you know, I suppose for them, they're all sort of ones just started secondary school, but they're primary school age. You know, so the world I inhabit is not really, it's not cool for a 9-year-old or whatever. But that's the interesting thing, isn't it? Because we all have that, like teachers at school who didn't know, who weren't interested in the things that we were interested in. Like, you know, I grew up listening to the radio, knew all the charts, but the teachers at school were of a different generation and they would never understand that. But now I'm somebody who's teaching students and I grew up with all that music and often draw on it in my teaching. But it's like, when I was at a university, if you saw your lecturer in the supermarket, it was the weirdest thing in the world, because you're thinking, they do their own shopping, you know, because it's that mystique. But these days, I mean, there's me going to the cinema, taking selfies of myself. Yeah. If one of my tutors did it in those days, I'd think there's something really wrong here. But now I don't think, you know, but then I thought, what do my students think of all these posts? Then I thought, I bet they don't care, don't even look. So again, I'm looking through a lens.
Yeah.
that is shaped by what I thought was the right thing to do, the normative lens from the 1980s mm-hmm. or so. Mm-hmm. The students who we teach now who were born in well into the 2000s, like yep. 2005, 6 or whatever, yep. you know, then it probably doesn't surprise them in the least. So when I started in this profession, I used to wear a tie. Yeah. Because I wanted to, because I was not that much older than the students, and it was my way of distinguishing mm-hmm. myself. And, you know, it was almost like, that's what I'm supposed to do, isn't it? That's the uniform, isn't it, I'm supposed to wear. And now, there's a part of me that wants to de-age almost, that sort of to be younger and all that sort of stuff. So it's all these sort of things that go through. But all I'm doing is often measuring myself by a standard mm-hmm. that once existed, but which surely doesn't exist anymore, but we're still beholden to it.
Which has just changed. Yeah. It's yeah. just shifted around yeah. As things do. Yeah. Yeah. I had that moment too where at some point it became... it was no longer ambiguous whether it was like similar to the students or just in a totally different generation. And once that line passed, then I started to, you know, notice that the gray is really coming in more quickly and so on. But up until that point, you're just like, how do I look like an adult here? I'm the adult in the room. But yeah, I think we all go through that point and then we're like, oh no. The moment's passed.
Yeah, but it also happens when you go back and you meet those people who taught you. I've interviewed for my podcast as well, people who taught mm-hmm. me. And of course, suddenly, you know, there's that expression about the boot being on the other foot.
Yeah.
But it's so deeply ironic that suddenly the people that you look up to are now people who've, you know, often retired, and you're meeting them in a different sort of capacity.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And suddenly you think that suddenly you're the person who has, I'm not going to say the power, but that's what I mean.
Yeah.
And suddenly you're controlling the agenda. But I've also found this with some people I've interviewed as well. Even the she's now left that school, but the head teacher at mm-hmm. my children's primary school. And I never knew how to talk to her in the sense that it's almost like I'm just obviously just a parent. But, you know, if I'd see her in the playground, I would just be stupid. All I could ever think of was, oh, talk about the weather. And I was mm-hmm. thinking, this is crazy. But, you know, so once I thought, but she was from, that's right, she spent a lot of time in Africa mm-hmm. and she fled Mugabe. Mm-hmm. And there was a school project on Africa once. And for that, I thought, I have to interview you because I didn't know all about that backstory. And we had an amazing interview. Mm-hmm. We did it and she was very forthcoming and lovely interaction. But then the next time I saw her, it was back to the, the weather? It was awkward. And so suddenly, it's like the podcast was able to have that moment where I kind of know what I'm doing.
Kind of space outside of...
But you find that it's the supermarket thing as well, isn't it? Because if you're in the supermarket, then you're in somebody else's space. You're at the checkout. You're talking to the person. It's like they're the one. They have the power in a way that they're, you know, you're the customer, but they're the ones who know the space, and you know they tell you to hurry up or move on or go to another checkout, whatever it might be. And it's maybe the same with our students. But when you change the mm-hmm. the context, mm-hmm. then you don't always know how to interact with that person because you're thinking, well, the thing you have in common is the thing that when you're not in that environment doesn't apply. So you're never quite sure mm-hmm. where there is a line to be crossed.
Yeah. No, it just comes to mind. I was having coffee with a former undergrad student who I supervised her thesis, and she's an undergrad here. And now she's a PhD student in Edinburgh. And I was recently in Edinburgh for doing examining a viva there. And so we met up for coffee. And there was a moment where she was going to pay for our coffees. But then I was like, oh, God, no. Like, I make more money than you. Like, I want it. But I think in her head, she was like, but you're visiting as Edinburgh, so I'm kind of like the host. Like, you know, like you're on my campus. So it was kind of a funny moment. But it's just when these very tightly constrained kind of configuration gets a little bit unhooked or something.
Yeah. Oh no, that happened. I interviewed a former student, and she said, "Oh, stay with us in my, you know, in a house in Nottingham, and oh, stay." And then she said, "Oh, go out for a meal." And she said, and said that very thing. She said that she'd be insulted if I got my wallet out. She said, "You know, you're visiting me She said that, you know, she's paying. And you know, it was very interesting. But I know, but of course, former student, and that's the thing.
And that's
exactly it. It's like, how do you navigate this one?
Yeah.
But also, that's what I kind of like, because we build up all these expectations, sometimes real, sometimes imagined.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we imagine about, you know, what people do in their, not I don't mean in their private life, but I mean that you know them in the morning. Good example is Facebook. In the early-ish days of Facebook, well, early for me, this is about 2012, but, you know, mm-hmm. 5 years into Facebook, mm-hmm. One of our PhD students said that in order to be, you know, to get down with the kids,
yeah,
you know, she said, we'll give the staff access to this created page, this configured page for the department. So it was effectively a Facebook page for mm-hmm. religious studies mm-hmm. students. What it really was students at the university who were, you know, going out to the union bar, and they were just posting pictures, dancing, and doing all the stuff that 18-year-old students do. But I saw some of them, and I thought, if they knew I could see these, they'd probably be mortified, because, you know, in class, these are students who would, you know, obviously contribute and do all the things that they're supposed to do in class, mm-hmm. but I just saw a different side to them. And I thought, they'd be mortified if I knew. So at the time, I thought, I really shouldn't be looking at this. And it was all done in good faith, because it was the sort of, let's bring the department together. But again, you see, when you see people or understand people outside of the context which you know them, we sometimes forget that they have real lives,
mm-hmm.
because we see them wearing a hat, as it were, mm-hmm. and we imagine that that's what they do.
Yeah.
And when they're not in the classroom, we don't imagine that they're listening to podcasts, or listening to, these days we probably mm-hmm. would, but back then the thought that they might be watching Top of the Pops, or they might be listening to the radio and the things that we do, unheard of, because that doesn't fit with that identity that's been constructed.
Well, I think actually this is something that this is something that really differs from person to person, because we all know that one person who, they kind of have little regard for what context they're in. They just act the same way they always act, and for better or worse. And then there are those people who, and I think I'm probably one of the ones I'm more on that side, who are very guarded about exactly how they present themselves in a particular context, and then they go to a different context, and then they present themselves differently in that context. I'm not saying I'm always like that, but, you know, people differ on that dimension, I think, quite widely. I think I do have a bit of a neurotic streak. I'm not sure exactly how to describe it, but to kind of feel like I'm in control of how I portray myself in a particular context. But then, of course, you do run into this thing where once the contexts get blurry, or once you kind of are in two contexts at the same time, or you're, especially like if you're interacting with people from one but also the other, and you're all in the same situation, then those things do get a little bit messy. But I don't not enjoy it. I kind of like encountering those weirdnesses.
It's traversing boundaries, but it's a way, and it's also what we all do when we grow up, because it's when you go back to a hometown or you meet people from your childhood, on one level you're transported back to that 7-year-old self or whatever it might be. But there's also a sense that you're now adults, and you may have children with you, or whatever, mm-hmm. you know. And suddenly there is something that's also shifted. But there are sometimes when I sometimes feel, I've managed to overcome that hurdle, that maybe there are things that have been bugging you for years, that maybe there was something about your relationship with that person that never quite clicked or something. And all these years later, maybe you're now doing something. They might say, gosh, you know, wow, you're doing amazing things. But back then, they were the people who were, you know, people I went to school with, who were always getting all the straight A's and getting, you know, they were like so academic and amazing. And then in a way that I wasn't in the same way. But then years later, for whatever reason, personal circumstances, mm-hmm. their life takes a different sort of turn. But we imagine, or I imagine, that when you see them, it's back to those same dynamics. Mm-hmm. That because they were really like the clever kid in the classroom, you imagine you're going to see that clever kid in the classroom again. But in reality, things may have happened that actually they are no longer doing anything remotely of that kind. And something has shifted. And that maybe you inhabit that space that maybe they once inhabited all those years ago. And it's fascinating to observe. But to observe it through interaction, to observe it not just through, as I was giving the example earlier, of watching something on TV or mm-hmm. film from a different country, but actually because it's happening maybe in your environment, mm-hmm. their environment, or a mutual or, you know, a third space that is new to both of you, and watching the way that the environment impacts on the dynamic.
Mm-hmm. You don't know how that friend thought of you when you were both seven.
Yeah.
But yeah, I did have one very awkward friend request on Facebook once from a girl who was quite mean to me in high school. I didn't accept it because she was mean to me, but also because she sent the request with a message saying, "You seem cool now. Let's be friends."
Yeah. Well, I feel even to this day that I still have something to prove, which is interesting to people who I haven't seen probably in 40 years. I'm 51, so we're talking primary school was more than 40 years ago or 40 years ago. And these things stay with you. And I see that's the thing, because the nostalgia. When I first did my podcast in 2018, I was about to go to my first ever university reunion, and I wasn't in the right position in my life to go, and I was a little anxious about going. And this is what I imagined. I imagined that suddenly all the people that I went to university with would be there, the same people, obviously a bit older, but that it was the same. I'd go back, and the people who I knew all those years ago would be there again. And part of me thought, oh gosh, well, if I see that person, I'll be very embarrassed or awkward, or how will I feel about seeing that person after all these years? When I went there, it wasn't at all like that, because I was there, but most of the people didn't go. And somehow I was just imagining that the reunion meant everybody from your childhood, everybody from your university years was going to reassemble. And of course, that's not what happened. In reality, I met all these new friends, in some cases people who'd been to the same place I went to university two or even three decades before I did. So people who were in their 70s, who'd gone there in the 1960s. And that shifted something. And I thought, oh, hang on. You know, I was just in a very narrow way imagining going back and going back over the same dynamics. And I thought, I can't handle that again, because you could imagine, you know, if you were a bit of a shy, awkward person then, then suddenly, you know, a university lecturer who's used to dealing with people, but suddenly, you know, losing your voice, or suddenly somebody else having all those, you know, having the power that they always used to have because you've never experienced anything else. So not so much with the university people, because I'm in touch with them all the time. But there is something about some of those school days that I still feel I have something to prove. And there's a part of me that sometimes wants to do two things. One is to boast and to show off, say, hey, look, I'm doing all this radio stuff, or I'm doing all this stuff. And there's another part of me that also, you know, kind of feels as well that somebody's going to say, oh, look at that silly Chris DC or something, you know, or because he's, you know, what an idiot sort of thing. And those two work together. That almost wants to sort of show off and say, look, I'm doing amazing things. But on the other hand, doing that because you also know that they're judging you, and you don't really know whether they've changed over the years. The bullying thing is an interesting one that you mentioned, because we think back to how, you know, obviously we feel about the bully, and she obviously was not a very nice person, obviously, from what you've said.
Or just but
what's her perception? Does she have any, and you obviously may not and rightly don't want to know, but do you think, has she in any way changed or grown? Does she have families or children or anything that have made her rethink or recalibrate the sort of person that she was? And in a way, there's no, you know, you haven't, it's not, you know, you don't need to know the answer to that. But that's, for me, the fascinating bit. I interviewed somebody once who said, she said she'd been waiting 50 years or something like that for this. She looked at the very microphone that we're looking at, you know, talking through now. And she said, I've waited 50 years for this. And she mentioned, she reeled off three names of people who'd bullied her at school back in the 1950s.
Yeah.
And she said, they made her life hell. And she said, I've taken all these years. And luckily for me, that the names, they were Welsh names, and they were, you know, it's like Evans and Williams and Davis. And it didn't obviously point to like one individual or three individuals.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course I was thinking, oh gosh, you know, is it okay to put this out? But she needed to say it, and it took her a long time.
Yeah.
But we all carry those, is what I'm saying. Were you happy not to respond? Or was there ever a sense that this person tried to get hold of you again, or do you think maybe she had a few drinks one evening, saw your profile, commented, and then forgot about it?
I don't know. And actually, I was like quite thankful for her for adding that little note, because it just makes things crystal clear for me. Yeah. And I was like, I don't actually need to prove anything to you.
Well, from my point of view, that's the thing. And of course, because I know you as an actor, you know, you've got, obviously, you're very learned, you write books, you've got a PhD and university position, and that goes for me as well.
Yeah.
So in that sense, there's never anything to prove, because that sort of comes with the territory. But when you have accomplished something, and of course, you're in a completely different part of the world, mm-hmm. And I don't know if she's still in, you would maybe even know, but you imagine, you imagine she's living in the same house, you imagine that in America. Yeah. But that's the thing, because the shift is when you imagine that they're kind of still the same, and you know that you don't want to be associated with or labelled in the way that you were, in such a hurtful way at the age of whatever it was when that mm-hmm. happened. Mm-hmm. And that's the twist, that you just ignore it because you don't need to prove anything. Because from my point of view, it's obvious, you were talking, it's like, well, of course you've got nothing to prove. And yet I'm in the same position as you and feel I have things to prove. So I think we all carry those challenging sort of stories with us.
I think as I get older, so I'm 42 going on 43, as I've gotten older, especially over the past decade, 15 years, sometimes I think I've gotten better at just letting go of some things. I mean, and maybe other people might have a different kind of view and think maybe no, these things are worth working through and worth kind of unraveling so that they don't trouble you anymore. But I've actually, for quite a few things in my past, where I have just thought, I don't want to wrestle with this anymore. So I'm just going to let it go. And I think that actually, doing that for a couple of key things has been really, really crucial and kind of liberating, and just allowed me to go on and do the rest of my life rather than kind of like grappling with these things that are really difficult in the past and maybe would take lots of effort and time that I just kind of don't want to do anymore.
Well, there's also the thing as well that we have the luxury, I think everybody has it, but we have the luxury of being able to construct our narrative to a large extent, mm-hmm. because we have a very bespoke one that nobody you would have gone to school with will have had your biography. Nobody, you know, to be a celebrated linguist who moved to Canterbury, and you know, your life story is completely, you know, is unique. There's no one else who will have that same story. Impossible. And that's the thing, isn't it? Because when you grow up, you're all in, the thing that you have in common is that your parents happen to live nearby and they chose that school for you. So there's all those sort of elements that these are people, it's not so much that you chose them as friends, but they are what's available because somebody else made choices for you on your behalf, and that's what you're with. All these years later, you've made your own decisions, that nobody made you come to Canterbury. That was mm-hmm. completely your decision. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, you've obviously got all of this. You know, you've made it. You've accomplished your own dream in your own way, your own fashion. But that's the thing. And I've had this when people have been in touch with me, mm-hmm. and people, when I have in the past re-established contact with them, that you're suddenly sucked back into those dynamics mm-hmm. that made it impossible to sort of get on with them in the first place. Mm-hmm. And what I learned, and this has been really recent for me mm-hmm. as well, and it goes against my character in a way, mm-hmm. which is to ignore them, not to respond to them. Mm-hmm. Now, that's utterly against my nature. It doesn't, you know, but I also realise how toxic it can be sometimes mm-hmm. when you engage. And the person might be, oh, hi, I haven't heard from you. What are you up to? I really want to hear from you. And you get in touch. And then within a few messages, a few exchanges, you're suddenly caught back in something that you really, and you thought, oh, I thought I told myself I'd never get into this again. And it's almost like this double life, because you've got that sort of dynamic, which is not very good. But then there's another dynamic, the professional one, sometimes when you think, hang on a minute, I'm the person who is the expert in blah, blah, blah. And then suddenly you're like, oh, no, I'm in control of that narrative, but I'm not in control of that one. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of been my life. And I think also it's an impetus for the podcast, mm-hmm. because it's trying to navigate those spaces of being passionate about things and having a driver to do some things, but also to feel and to know that sometimes there are some things that are just unfinished. and maybe will always be incomplete, or actually that are, you can't handle them, you can't maneuver them, navigate them in the same way that you will those things where you are in control, where professionally you know you're allowed to do ABC. And you said, I was thinking, gosh, one part of me is doing these amazing things, the other part of me is back to that 17-year-old self, and in the same toxic dynamic with that person, and that's curious. And you suddenly think, gosh, maybe we can't escape our pedigree, our destiny.
Do you know, actually, talking about different parts of life, the part of my life where I felt truly for the first time like these are kind of my people, even though we have many differences, is that first era of PhD years of grad school, because that was really the first time when we were a handful of us in this program, all for the same reason, right? We all had shared interests and so on. And of those, a few kind of had their own lives, had families and so on. But then the remaining, there was a kind of small handful of us, and we were at UCLA. So there were, I mean, not all of us, but many of us were kind of from California and so on. And, you know, that was the first time when I made a friend who's still a friend who was like me. Mm. So he always was like a super linguistics nerd and like was into all these things, not always the same things, but, you know, he was also the child of an immigrant family, you know, and not of the same immigrant background, but different ones. So we had kind of analogous upbringings, and, you know, living in the Southern California in an immigrant context, and had the same kind of local history, you know. So like the LA riots, LA uprising happened when I was like 12, right? So we had that kind of shared history as well, and had the experience of going to uni and then coming back. So that was kind of the first time I'd ever met someone who was like, oh, yeah, you kind of have, we have parallel versions of each other's lives. And actually, that person is someone that I've been able to have like quite in-depth, quite nuanced conversations with about a lot of things where with someone else, there would just be a lot of explaining to do, and then you get tired doing the explaining, and then you can't actually get to the real thing. So, So those friends from that era are the ones that are still friends. So anyone from before that, I'm kind of nominally in touch with on Facebook, but not really. Yeah. They seem quite distant.
But also curious, and well, not in any way surprising, that the people that you're closest to are those where professionally you were making a real, you know, name for yourself, that you were doing, that you had agency, you were proactive, you were doing things professional, and you have kept in touch with those people because you've been on that journey together. And in a way, there's nothing to prove. But as you say, it's those people who maybe led a very different life and are still judging you or still identify, I don't just be you personally, but, you know, I'm thinking myself as well in a sense, by a criteria that might have existed in, you know, 1980 something or whatever, and which we, you know, but, and maybe they're not thinking that anymore. That's the curious thing. It's sometimes, you know, we know we've moved on, but we don't always know if other people have or have the capacity to. And sometimes we have reason for not really wanting to find out either, because we don't necessarily think that it's healthy to go back, or you need to be given, or maybe no friends of friends of friends who can also say, yeah, this is fine, this is, you know, this is felicitous rather than toxic. And you're sort of thinking, yeah, but, you know, do I need, you know, how much of an investment does this warrant? That leads on to something, because as we start to wrap up, Christina, because that whole thing, I always ask in the interview, that whole thing about whether negative experiences are things that we can ever be nostalgic about. In other words, nostalgia, I think we had a pre sort of email conversation before the interview in which we were sort of talking about, you know, what actually is nostalgia. There's a big part of me that is excited about the past, but also fearful of it. And that's exactly the tension. It is literally the bittersweet. There are things that I love and things that I don't love, but you can't have one without the other. And I've started to grasp that, maybe in more recent years, But it's, so in a way, nostalgia is the lens. So it's not about going back and living the life again that maybe didn't exist in the first place. It's the lens in the present that may be a way of dealing with something in the present that is defective or challenging for us. But does any of that sort of make sense? That sort of, you know, can you be nostalgic about negative experiences?
Yeah. Well, yes. Setting aside the... So I think on the one hand, there are kind of negative experiences or contexts or people or whatever that where at least for me I sense that there's a clear it clearly helps me in a way to simply cut that off and leave it in the past. And then there are a whole bunch of other things that I think fall into this category of kind of things weren't all good or all bad, but they were kind of this weird mixture of sometimes quite unpleasant things. And I think those do shape you. And those are things that I don't, where I don't feel the need to, you know, kind of, you know, cut those things off and leave them, you know, leave them in the past and not think about them. Because those are exactly the kind of context and situations where, you know, you get older and then you experience more stuff and then you come back and think about it and it may look a bit different or you may understand how it has affected you in the years intervening in a slightly different way.
They are the drivers, aren't they? They're the thing, because if you're going to overcome something, well, if there was nothing to overcome, if nothing bad ever happened, well, there would be something we'd feel diminished in some way, which is power. Or maybe we wouldn't, or maybe it's because we're used to, like, we're both in an institution that's going through interesting changes. So there's always a set, there's always something that we don't want. But it, I mean, in my case, because this will go out with my 200th interview, but yeah, I mean, I won't be working at the university for very much longer. But but in a way that can be scary, but it's also liberating.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't, if you'd said to me 10 years ago that might happen, I might not imagine that I could possibly imagine that that could be something to be positive about. So it's the paradox. I suppose nostalgia ultimately is a paradox.
Now you're making me think, who knows where I'll be in 5 years' time, but oh, who knows what this time right now will look like when I look back on it. Certainly. I think it's just misleading to say this was a good time in my life or a bad time in my life. I think they're formative in many ways and just, you know, they shape you going forward.
But sometimes you know when something's happening that it's good or bad.
Yeah.
But other times, I mean, having a diary helps with that you look back and you think, oh, actually, that's not, you know, what you thought at the time may not match the memory. Mm-hmm. Or often there's the composite nature of memory, that sometimes you imagine all the things from a particular era happening at once, or you consolidate many episodes into one. But in reality, you know, even if you had a really successful, you know, job or university experience, mm-hmm. there were always going to be things with friends or illnesses or worried about your accommodation or worried about your next deadline or getting a job, all these sort of things that sort of go on. And if you do well, if you get a good result and you get a first class degree and everything is great, but everything that got to that point may have actually been hard. I had a student once who got a very good mark, a very good first, and I said congratulations. She was the last to leave the room, so I said, oh, well done, you know, really good essay.
Mm-hmm.
She burst into tears. And I thought, that doesn't make any sense. You should be really happy, dancing on the table, you know. No. And of course she said that to get that first, she had to sacrifice sleep, had to take medication. She had to go to the doctors. She was ill. She said, I can't sustain this. And she did get first in the end about 2 years later. But that was a lesson to me as well, that just because somebody gets a really good mark doesn't mean to say that it was effortless for them. And although it's right to say congratulations, what she probably realised is, yeah, I got the mark I wanted, but at a price that I don't think is sustainable. So again, that was a life lesson for me, like the educator being educated by the student who made me revisit, you know, the idea of somebody attends every single class, and is a diligent student doesn't mean to say that their life is amazing in every way, because you see them there and you think, oh, they're dedicated, keep it up. Actually, in a way, that's the worst thing you can say, because keep it up to them might mean keep up a lifestyle that could actually lead to ruin.
Yeah.
You can't sustain
yeah.
it.
No, yeah. That reminds me of this. A professor I knew back in the States told me a story once. So in the American system, there's tenure. So, okay, work really, really, really hard and your life is kind of really hard until you apply for tenure, then you get tenure, hopefully. And she said that the night of the day she found out she had tenure, she did not know why, but she was furious. She was furious. She just swept everything off her table and she was kind of like walking around furious and not knowing what to do with herself on campus late at night. And another professor, a more senior professor, told her this story about this monkey study that was done once. You give this monkey a little ball, it's like a puzzle, and they can play around with it and open it, and they learn how to do that. Then you start putting a peanut on the inside, and guess what? They get even better at it. They get excellent at it every time you give them a new one. And then you remove the peanut. And then the first time they do that, after you remove the peanut, they open it, and there's nothing there. They throw a fit. They are so mad. They're so upset. And you know what? That makes perfect. Anyone who hears that story, that makes perfect sense. Like, once you've trained me and trained me and trained me to work towards this thing, and then you finally say, like, okay, it's over now. You don't know how to do any other thing or act any other way. But this like kind of rage reaction. I remember that. But yeah, you reminded me of that with this achieving a first, but you know, that just kind of it covers over, like, you don't know just from looking at the student, like, what did it take to get there?
Yeah, and I remember as well, I mean, I remember when, because I studied Scorsese a lot for my, I mean, he was, like, the greatest director, never to have won an Oscar. Mm-hmm. When he did win the Oscar, the strange thing is, suddenly he had the very thing that, in not having, made him such an interesting person. But when he had it, although I was so delighted and would have been devastated if he hadn't won on the umpteenth attempt, there was a little bit of something that, because no longer was he the greatest director and never won an Oscar.
Yeah.
He was another great director who won an Oscar.
Yeah.
And perhaps arguably didn't win for his best film, etc. So in that sense, something shifted. Like anyway, it's not a matter. But something,
strange, right?
Something, you know, fell out of alignment. But I've got one more question to ask you, which is, Christina, whether you consider yourself to be a looking back or a looking forward kind of person.
Oh.
I always finish with that question.
Yeah, I know.
It's
Despite all the things I've said about leaving things behind in the past, I think I'm more of a looking back person than I am a looking forward person. Why? I'll tell you why. One reason, at least. I like to analyze things, right? That's why I love a good meaty film where, you know, you need to view it a few times. That's why I love it. This is why I never went into something like literary theory for work, because I just love that stuff for fun, right? And that's how much I'm interested in. But I really love analyzing and then reanalyzing and then kind of developing an understanding of kind of a meaty set of things, whether that's memories or, you know, cultural, historical context or whatever it is. But I think I just can't help myself. You know, there are certain things where I just have said goodbye to them and they're no longer really part of my day-to-day life. But there's so many things where, you know, something happens today or tomorrow and I can't help but start contextualizing that. You know, given everything I know about myself and all the people and contexts around me. So I think, in a way, yes. Not that I try to, but I think that's just my natural inclination, is to view things that way.
And of course, that's the thing. We are who we are. We are where we are now because of all the different steps along the way. So the analytical mind can never escape that. And that's a good thing. Surely it has to be good. Well, Christina, it has been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for being my guest this week.
Thank you, Chris. And so delighted to know I'm your 200th episode. That feels special somehow. And congratulations with all the exciting stuff that's going on for you.
Thank you, Christina.